This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to broadcast the 26th Annual Waterfront Blues Festival, a benefit for the Oregon Food Bank, because no one should go hungry. Thursday through Sunday, July 4th through 7th, KBOO will broadcast live from Tom McCall Waterfront Park to the Portland metro area. Throughout Oregon, via radio partners in Ashland, Bend, Newport, Warm Springs, Salem, and more, as well as web streaming at kboo.fm. More information about admission, performers, and benefits for KBOO members can be found at kboo.fm.
Tune in to Plugged In every first and third Fridays from 10 p.m. to midnight with host DJ Tronic. Tronic does a live mix in the studio featuring the latest in house, techno, tech house, breaks, dubstep, and more. Tronic also has guest DJs in the studio and often talks about upcoming parties, club nights, and more. That's Plugged In, every first and third Fridays at 10 p.m., only on KBOO Portland.
You are tuned to KBOO Portland, where the time is approximately 9:02 a.m., coming up this morning on KBOO at 9, APA Compass features Professor Linda Tamura, author of Nikkei, Soldiers Break Their Silence, Coming Home to Hood River. At 10, both Air Cascadia and Flashpoints are off today. Instead, we'll hear Radio EcoShock on preparing personal solutions, clothes, medicine, money, food. At 11, on It Takes a Village, host Shahid Hamid interviews Michael Alexander, president of the Urban League of Portland. And at 11:30, we hear an interview with writer and activist Rebecca Solnit on her book, Hollow City, which she wrote to document the beauty and rich culture of San Francisco that was being destroyed by wealth, and to inspire the growing movement of resistance. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you are not a member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and click on Donate Today. Stay tuned for APA Compass.
Good morning, I'm Andrew Yeh, and thanks for tuning in to APA Compass, the Pacific Northwest's only Asian Pacific American public affairs radio program. APA Compass airs the first Friday of each month at 9 a.m. Today's show features two communities whose stories were too long held in silence. Sarika Mehta interviewed the talented filmmaker Vidyut Lathe. Her documentary, Beyond Silence, explores the lives of the deaf community in India. But first, we'll hear from my interview with Professor Linda Tamura, author of Nikkei Soldiers Break Their Silence, on why Hood River, Oregon received national notoriety after World War II, and why the Nikkei soldiers at the heart of it were so reluctant to talk about it. Thanks for listening to APA Compass. I'm Andrew Yeh, and on today's show, we welcome Professor Linda Tamura, author of Nisei Soldiers Break Their Silence, Coming Home to Hood River. Professor Tamura is a professor of education at Willamette University, and this is her second book on the long-established Japanese and Japanese-American community in Hood River, Oregon. Linda, welcome to APA Compass.
Thank you very much.
So how did there grow to be such a large Japanese-American community in the Hood River area?
It actually started with the Hood River apples. Hood River had a strong reputation for the quality of its apples, and that was because of Mount Hood. The fertile volcanic soil was just prime for raising quality apples. In fact, by 1893, Hood River had received 16 international awards for its apples. So East Coast families actually were enticed by getting a piece of Hood River's land where you could pay $300 per acre and make a profit by the sixth year. And by the 10th year, your property would be worth $3,000 per acre. So they sent their East Coast sons, who were Ivy League graduates, to come to the valley to get a piece of this action. The challenge was that these East Coast sons, who were smart and very ambitious, were not so adept at manual labor. And so when they came to Hood River and saw the heavy stands of conifers, they immediately recognized that the Issei were in the valley working on the railroads, and they gave them an incentive. They offered 5 acres of stump land or brush land or swampland if they would clear 15 acres of land for them. So as a result then, Hood River Issei actually began to own more property. Their property was intermingled with other white farmers, and they became quite prosperous. In fact, by 1920, they owned more than half the land that Issei, the first generation, owned in Oregon.
Anti-Chinese sentiment in eastern Oregon and the entire United States was common during the early 1900s. What was the sentiment towards the Hood River Japanese and Japanese Americans?
Much the same. In fact, it was exacerbated in Hood River because of the productivity of the Issei on their property. Because while they waited for their seedlings to bear fruit, they needed to gain some quick cash crops. So they actually raised asparagus and strawberries in between the rows of their seedlings. And by 1920, they raised 75% of the strawberries in Hood River, and they shipped about 50,000 crates of asparagus. So they were becoming productive. They were owning land, their intensive farming practices were bearing fruit, and residents were becoming skeptical. So by 1913, the first anti-alien land bill in Oregon was actually proposed by a Hood River senator. And by 1919, the Hood River residents formed an anti-alien association.
Now, I think that, you know, the Japanese have been around for many years at that point, many decades at that point. They've started raising their children there. Their children go to the same schools as the Caucasians. Wouldn't there be an opportunity to befriend the Japanese Americans that are there? Or is that not happening?
Actually, many of the youth who were the second generation, the Nisei, so they were the children of the Issei who had immigrated. They were raised as American citizens. They learned Japanese at home, and they ate Japanese food. But when they went to school, they learned American ways, and they thought they were all American kids, and they did make friends. When they made those kinds of connections, there was no animosity. But economics did prove to be a deterrent because farmers and business people began to be concerned about Issei productivity, the fact that the Nisei children not only went to school, but they also helped on the family farm. And the mothers of those children, too, not only took care of the children, but they also worked on the farm. So there was skepticism. In fact, the Hood River mayor at that time had been very critical of the Japanese families because he said the whole family gets out and works on the farm. In fact, some of the Issei would tell their children on Saturdays and Sundays that it would be better for them to work inside the rows in the orchard rather than working along the road because they might be seen by others.
So what prompted you to write this book, Nisei Soldiers Break Their Silence?
This actually began when I was examining my grandmother's life. I was prompted by my uncle to interview my grandmother, who had been a picture bride. So even though she spoke Japanese and I spoke English, through my mother's translations, I decided I was going to interview her and learn about her life. Through the process of learning about Grandma's immigration and her early settlement as an Issei woman who worked on the farm and raised her children, I became aware that Hood River was a place that had gained national notoriety during the war. And I happened to be sitting in the basement of our local library examining back issues of the Hood River News when I came across full-page advertisements with statements such as, "Japs not wanted in Hood River." It's hard for me to even say that word. There were statements that my parents and my grandparents were not welcome to come back from the camps or from their military service. There were six full-page ads, and underneath were the names of citizens who purportedly were voicing that opinion that Japanese Americans were not welcome back. I recognized some of those names. And some of those people were friendly to me. I could not understand what had happened during the war to prompt them to sign that, and what had happened to create such dissension in my community. At that point, I began to raise questions about what had occurred, why people didn't talk about it, why there was a silence about Japanese Americans in the community, and why even my friends, my white friends, didn't know about it. I guess the biggest issue, too, as one who was raised in Hood River, was that I had studied American history. I had studied local history, and there was no place where I learned about Japanese Americans going to camps, Japanese Americans serving in the war, and definitely what had happened in my community. So I was prompted to ask more questions and learn about what had occurred in the past. That was difficult because people didn't want to talk about it. My family was concerned about talking about it. The veterans were not interested in voicing their experiences during the war. I think Japanese Americans had also learned that by not speaking about the past, it made it okay to get along because it was a painful period. They felt uncomfortable with it. And also members of the white community also didn't want to talk about it. So in some ways, there was a code of silence, as if we ignore it, maybe it'll go away. But that's not a way to heal. My effort was to break that code of silence. I'm a teacher, and I'm eager to help others learn. I want them to learn by looking at different points of view, different perspectives. And there was no perspective. There was no story. So my goal was to get the story, to interview as many people as possible, to look at as many documents as possible, and to gain as many perspectives as possible so that the story would come out.
So how did you convince the veterans to tell their stories?
I began with three veterans. One veteran was my father. One veteran was my uncle, who had actually translated interviews I conducted with the Issei, the first generation, for my first book. So my uncle and my father told me that they weren't really interested in talking, but they would do so because I was their daughter and I was their niece. I also invited George Akiyama, who had been heroic in Europe, to join us. And because he felt favorably about my uncle and my father, and because his mother had also been interviued by me for the Issei book. We began at my parents' house, and I asked general questions about retirement and about their experiences currently, and then my mom made a fabulous lunch. The next day, we went to Panorama Point, where we could look down on the gorgeous Hood River Valley and look up at Mount Hood. And at that point, I asked the three veterans to talk about the Issei and the orchards that they had raised and their hard work. And they were very eager to talk about their parents. Then we went to Idlewild Cemetery, and we stood at Frank Hachia's gravesite. They saluted him, and they talked about how honorably he had served. And then finally, we went to Taro Asai's orchard, and they immediately walked out, checked the quality of the trees and the buds, and they were right at home. And I talked to them then about their experiences as orchardists. So after those 2 days, they were feeling much more comfortable. They had shared together, and they were each willing to speak with me individually. I expanded by interviewing members of their family so I could get other perspectives. And then I also interviewed other Japanese-American veterans from Hood River, other Japanese-American veterans from outside Hood River, and Joan Yasui Emerson joined me in interviewing members of the white community as well. There was an opportunity, too, to look at a lot of archival material. So I spent a lot of time looking at old issues of the Hood River News, the Hood River Sun, the Hood River Glacier, old minutes of the Chamber of Commerce. And I was invited to look at old files of the veterans group that had led the campaign against Japanese Americans.
So what did you find when you looked into the files about the people that were organizing against the Japanese Americans?
We found letters, I think about 500 letters that had been addressed to this organization after a particular incident. What had occurred on November 29, 1944, was that the names of 16 Nisei veterans were removed from an honor roll on the side of the courthouse where 1,600 GIs' names were inscribed. And this particular group had discouraged Japanese Americans from returning to the valley after the war. It had discouraged Nisei from serving in the military, and it had removed the names of the Nisei veterans from the board. When that happened, Hood River gained national notoriety. There were editorials in newspapers across the country, including the Chicago Sun, the New York Times. There were letters that were sent to the veterans group. Some of the letters said that they didn't consider themselves lovers of Japanese, but they also felt that because these GIs had served our country and were protecting us, that the action was notorious.
The GIs that returned to the Hood River area received very negative reception. Did this happen anywhere else in the U.S.?
Yes. Japanese Americans, as a rule, were not often welcomed when they came back to their communities. They'd been gone for 2.5 to 3 years. The government had stated that this was for their own protection and that they were a threat to the communities. So they were removed from the West Coast. And yes, when they came back to their homes along the West Coast, many faced discrimination. The difference in Hood River was that only 40% returned, and the population of Japanese Americans in the valley decreased by half. And much of that was because of the anti-campaigns that were led by the veterans group and by other citizens as well. There were, as I mentioned, six full-page ads with statements such as Japs not wanted in Hood River, signed by a total of 1,814 citizens who purportedly were very strongly stating that they did not want Japanese as neighbors. There was also a plan, and several of the ads listed those Issei and Nisei who own property, and the goal was, in future issues, to place check marks by their name to indicate that their property had been sold. The goal was to prevent them from coming back and becoming successful farmers. Another challenge was that when the Issei and Nisei left, their orchards were at the point where they were just beginning to be productive. So some of them sold their property because they didn't think they'd be coming back. Others found caretakers who took care of their property and also reaped the benefits. In one case, a caretaker rented the property for $1,000, and the gross net was $50,000 each year for 3 years. The War Relocation Authority of the United States actually did a study of what they called the Hood River situation and concluded that economics definitely was an issue that led the campaign against Hood River Nikkei return.
How did the Japanese American community respond? Did they come together when they're faced with this adversity?
Well, they really just tried to fit in. The Issei were not citizens. Most of them spoke Japanese, and they felt they didn't have any rights. The Nisei came back, and those who returned to Hood River joined their families and realized that the orchards where they had grown up as kids, the land that they had worked as kids, was suffering. It had, in many cases, suffered neglect for 2.5 to 3 years. They really put their energies into working the land. The other challenge was that when they returned, they saw the full-page ads. They often saw former classmates and realized that they were ignored. They were snubbed by people whom they knew. They couldn't leave because they had invested their time and their money and their energy into their property. So most of them stuck it out. They laid low. They tried not to call attention to themselves. They worked hard on their property to bring it back to fruition. And one by one, they tried to make connections with more people to help them see that they were reputable, that they were good American citizens, that this was the only country they knew. There was a group in Hood River who took a stand, and it was a very small group. They called themselves the League for Liberty and Justice, taken from the last few lines of the Pledge of Allegiance. They offered to meet Nikkei, the Japanese Americans, at the train stations when they returned, because there had been threats of reception committees that would meet them and turn them away. When Japanese Americans were not able to take their fruit to the warehouses, the members of this League for Liberty and Justice volunteered to drive them because often the warehouse workers would not take the fruit. So they did make small ventures. Reverend Sherman Burgoyne was the minister of the Asbury Methodist Church, and he was actually quite outspoken in advocating for Japanese Americans, so much so that he was actually turned away from many stores. Mrs. Arlene Moore, who co-owned Moore Electric in downtown Hood River, was elderly, and she walked with a cane. And yet Moore Electric became a haven for the Issei in particular. Issei men and women would often meet at Moore Electric, and Mrs. Moore hobbled out with the cane with their grocery lists, and she made purchases for them. But it was very difficult. Most of the stores in Hood River would not sell to Japanese Americans, so many of them were forced to travel 20 miles to the Dalles to make their purchases.
Could you give us a reading from your book?
Sure. As citizens who had served their country, Nisei veterans expected a warmer, more respectful welcome. Post-war Hood River resident and veteran Jan Kurahara lamented, "It's amazing what a uniform doesn't do for you. I should have been wearing a Japanese Imperial Army soldier's uniform for the disrespect the U.S. Army uniform was getting. I was told that they wouldn't serve me, nor would anybody else in town." Sab Akiyama received similar treatment when he disregarded the No Japs Allowed sign at the Rockford store he had once frequented in his Oak Grove community. Still wearing his uniform, he asked for a pack of cigarettes. "We don't have any cigarettes," the proprietor replied. "Oh, I'll have a glass of beer," Akiyama countered, noting men swigging ale at the bar. "Can't you read that sign?" the irate owner asked before ejecting him from the store. It was likewise an affront when a downtown barbershop denied service to Brother George Akiyama. Despite the silver and bronze stars and seven other decorations on his uniform. After the barber waved his razor and threatened, "I ought to slit your throat," Akiyama simply walked out, mumbling, "Boy, you're worse than some of the Germans we fought." By chance, Air Force Captain Sheldon Lawrence, a resident of Upper Valley Parkdale, had witnessed the entire incident. Though he and Akiyama were not acquainted, the officer drove west to Oak Grove and trudged the final half mile up the Akiyama's snow-covered hill so that he could apologize. In a letter to the Oregonian, Captain Lawrence denounced, quote, "such unjustified prejudice and insults," quote, "to some of the nation's best fighting men," end quote. Criticizing those who have not yet grown up, he added prophetically, "perhaps millions of returning veterans will help them." And in fact, returning veterans did speak out and did help to support the Nisei veterans.
How so?
While the Nisei veterans had felt very alone, the white veterans came back and spoke of the heroics of the Nisei veterans, and that really did help them to become more accepted in the community. Little by little, person by person, Japanese Americans began to demonstrate that they were honest, that they were upstanding citizens. And actually, one activity that helped them was bowling. It turned out that even though the American Bowling Congress had a whites-only policy until 1951, the owner of the bowling alley in Hood River was an ex-sergeant from New York. And so after hours, he decided that Nisei veterans didn't have a lot of recreation, and so he invited them to bowl. At 10 o'clock, he locked the doors. He let five Nisei veterans come in and bowl. They didn't know how to bowl. They taught themselves. They set their own pins. But gradually, they became quite good, and they invited others to bowl. And eventually, there was a Nisei bowling league. And Hit Imai told me that they were having so much fun that after a while, others wanted to join them too. In fact, 10 years later, the veterans group that had led the campaign against Japanese Americans actually sponsored a Nisei bowling team. But still, people didn't talk about the past. And so my goal was to dig deeper, to hopefully build trust, to help others recognize that it's important that we learn from those stories, from Hood River's past.
So, Linda, what's next for you?
Yes, I'm excited because the Congressional Gold Medal was bestowed on all Nisei veterans in November 2011, and it was housed in the Smithsonian. 2 months ago, it began a national tour of seven cities. It'll be coming to Portland in August, and it'll be here through September at the Oregon Historical Society. I'm very gratified because I've been invited to help to curate a local exhibit that will feature Hood River Nisei veterans based on my book. So we'll also be able to tell the story of local Nikkei veterans and how they contributed to the overall story of Nisei who earned the Congressional Gold Medal. There's much to show, there's much to tell, and there's much to learn about our past.
Linda Tamura, thanks so much for talking with us today. Professor Linda Tamura is the author of Nisei Soldiers Break Their Silence, Coming Home to Hood River. I'm Andrew Yeh for APA Compass.
Good morning, and thanks for listening to APA Compass on KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland. I'm Sarika Mehta, and today we're featuring an interview with documentary filmmaker Vidyut Latte, director of the film Beyond Silence. Vidyut Latte is a filmmaker based out of Los Angeles, California. She was the executive director and producer for many radio and television programs in Mumbai, India. Currently, she is a filmmaking consultant with the Filmmakers Alliance in Los Angeles. Her documentary film, Beyond Silence, has been screening at festivals around the world. This film examines the deaf and hard of hearing community in Mumbai, India. But rather than painting a picture of patronizing disability, this film attempts to understand the deaf community from their own perspective. Back in March, I met Vidyut Latte outside the Union Station in Los Angeles. We talked about how she, as a hearing person, became interested in filming the deaf community.
I would say I was studying in San Francisco State University, doing my master's in radio and television. My emphasis was documentary filmmaking. And typically, you know, as you have your student jobs, one of my jobs was audiovisual technician. And while I was doing my job one day, I saw the president of the university was addressing a whole crowd of new students. I saw just beside him, there was a lady standing there signing simultaneously, right at the same time while he was talking. And I said, wow, I know this is sign language, but in all my 29 years of my life in India, of living there, I never saw anybody doing that at public places or at public conferences. And why is this complete neglect towards this community? And who are these people? And what kind of arrangements do I have in my country, you know, for these people? So that was, I would say, the trigger for me to get to know about the deaf community. And I kind of felt it was almost like a need for me to know about them. You know, it was an urge. And then I spoke to some people, and then that is how, you know, I came about actually working on this project. Yeah.
And you mentioned that your sister-in-law is an interpreter. So tell us about the experience of working with her and with the deaf community when you were developing this film.
Sure. So, yeah, as I said, I really got interested in the sign language and in trying to know about deaf community in India, because I knew it looked like, you know, obviously US had much more awakening, you know, in that sense about the community and about the language and their needs and their requirements. So I was just talking to my husband about it, and his sister, my sister-in-law, is in the profession of interpreting. She was actually training herself to become an interpreter that time, and I spoke to her and she was fascinated. She said, you know, I have so many things to share with you. And then we got talking, and then we got to know about the ratio of, you know, sign language interpreters to deaf people in India, and the lack of basic amenities, you know, in terms of having interpreters at public places. No, absolutely, you know, having sign language instruction at deaf schools, and the general, I would say, apathy towards the cause of deafness and deaf people in the home country. And one of the most important thing, I think, what she's shared with me was that the deaf people, they don't feel that, you know, they are lacking somewhere in any of the sensibilities of life, you know, which probably hearing people are always proud of. They feel they're very proud of being deaf. They just want the hearing community to accept that, acknowledge that. And I found that was very interesting. And my whole documentary is actually skewed towards that perspective, that, okay, there are nuances and there are aspects of, you know, what they're lacking in their life, but they are very vociferously trying to tell people that, yes, we are deaf. but we are proud to be deaf. Just hear us out, you know, quote unquote, and try to understand our perspective. Just don't try to make us hearing, you know, the way you are. You know, live and let live. Just let us be, you know, just try to give us the amenities that we deserve as the citizens of this country. And that what that entails is interpreters, you know, probably, you know, having medium of instruction as sign language in deaf schools, having many, many more interpreters at public places, having captioning services on television. You know, these are some of the important things that you need, you know, as any citizen, you know, as a legal citizen of a country.
And actually, that is a good transition to my next question. The deaf community has challenges in this country as far as rights and movements, but we at least have, from 1990, the Americans with Disabilities Act, which protects some of the rights and requires interpreting services and things like that.
Yeah.
Can you talk about the parallel of experiences and challenges in India with the deaf community?
Well, what I discovered during my research and while even shooting the documentary was that there's absolutely a very skewed ratio of what facilities and amenities that government, or for that matter, the society at large has provided to deaf people. The most current figures that I have with me, while I was shooting, actually, they were like really far, far different than what I have now. But they're still, you know, really alarming. That is, like, there are just 250 certified interpreters for around 18 million deaf people. That's one of the most recent figures that I've got from the census report from India. Now, 250 certified interpreters. When I say certified interpreters, they are not really, you know, regularly practicing interpreters. We don't know how many people really go out there in the field and do it day in and day out. We don't know that. But they are qualified, yes. So, again, you know, that's an alarming figure, because if you have 250 people for, like, really not good. So that is one of the things. There are no captions on television. Because I guess there is this big myth in India, and maybe in many other countries, that all deaf people can lip read. And this is one of the biggest myths. And Mike Morgan, a linguist and deaf activist, and I have interviewed him for my documentary, and he actually threw some really fascinating insight into this. He said most deaf people cannot read lips 100% because it's impossible. It's impossible for anybody to read lips 100%. So this whole myth about, you know, when you have television going on, that deaf people can just look at the television announcers or, you know, characters and they can understand everything, it's just bizarre. So we don't have captions. We don't have good number of interpreters for people out there. There are more than, I think, 800 deaf schools in India. On an average, there are just like maybe one deaf interpreter available in every school. So most deaf schools don't have facilities of providing education to students in sign language. So the emphasis of providing education to deaf students is only through oral methods. And that is what is practiced, and that is what is encouraged and highly recommended. Even during the shooting of the documentary, I came across many schools and many educators who felt that it is for the benefit of the hearing people that deaf students should learn, you know, hearing methods, you know. I mean, they should learn to talk and learn to lip read. So this is another thing. This is the third thing. The fourth thing is that we don't really have the TTY service, the text phone service, where a deaf person can call a service where, and there is an interpreter waiting there. We don't have anything of that sort. Of course, we don't have a university or a separate college. There's absolutely none of these facilities available in India. So all in all, you know, the deaf community is really deprived in that sense, I would say.
This access to information for the Indian deaf and hard of hearing community is not only limited in the media, but in education as well. There is an unfortunate myth that all deaf people can read lips, and as a result, should be taught their academics in speech rather than sign language. Vidyut Latte expands on this. I wanted to go back to something you said at one of the schools, that they were talking about the benefit of hearing people. Maybe expand on what that means for our listeners who haven't yet seen your movie.
Yeah, so during my research and when I was shooting at one of the schools, it was a deaf school, and I mean, the people over there really were very welcoming, and they wanted to enforce what their side of thinking is, because I was trying to tell them what the deaf people feel. The deaf people typically feel that none of the deaf students who go to deaf school are really educated. They just cram the stuff, whatever, you know, lessons they are asked to learn every day. They just cram. They just try to, you know, just put it out there during examinations, and that's it. If they pass, that's it. They are promoted to the next level. Most of the students lose interest because they don't really get interested in the topic. If they use sign language, they'll be taught better. The deaf schools mostly don't use those tactics. They mostly emphasize only on oral communication. And the reason they say is that it's for the benefit of hearing people, because obviously the majority of the people around are hearing. And it is, in a way, a deficiency. You know, it is kind of something that deaf people lack in themselves, and hearing people are here to empower them by teaching them oral method, communicating in spoken languages. And that's what deaf schools are actually doing in India. And they believe that that is the only way you can educate deaf students. But deaf students and deaf activists have, you know, shared with me that that is not the right way to teach them. The best way is sign language and maybe bilingualism. That is the best way. You know, you can learn it. But the emphasis has to be on sign language, and that is not happening there.
This also brings up the point that India is super multilingual, and especially in a city like Bombay where your movie is shot. So we're talking about lip reading, and I know people code switch a lot across a variety of languages. For me, it begs the question how somebody can lip read across five languages,
exactly,
for one thing, and then be expected to achieve this with any grain of success. And also, with India having such pride in the many languages, or why is sign language in India not included in that pride?
There's not much awareness about it. That's the first thing. I mean, I have seen incidences while I was growing up there. If you see somebody signing, you know, at the railway station or at any public place, people used to ridicule that. You know, they were like, oh, who are these people and why are they signing? You know, there's just no awareness that this is a language, like all other spoken languages in the world. This is one of the languages that we need to accept. And there are people who use that language to communicate in their everyday life. And they're absolutely fine with it. You know, they have learned it. And there are hearing people now, like yourself, you know, who are learning it to become trained interpreters. I mean, there are linguists, you know, who have been studying this language for years now, you know. It's just that India right now, I mean, maybe things have changed in the past 3-4 years, but still now I would say there is not much awareness. I didn't feel, well, I was growing up. I'm talking about and sharing something while I was growing up there. You know, I lived there for like 20 or 29 years of my life, but there was not much awareness about it. Mostly, I would say the language is interpreted as gestures. There's a big difference between gestures and a language. I don't want to be judgmental only about Indian people, but probably where there is not much awareness about sign language, they probably interpret it as, oh, it's a language about gestures. These things are not true. I mean, people are educating themselves to have a bachelor's and master's and PhDs in sign language linguistics. We are talking about something really far away. But at this moment, why sign language and acceptance for the deaf life or deaf culture is not there, I think primarily is because of lack of awareness. Lack of awareness of the fact that there is a life that this community has imbibed, and they are very happy about having it, and they have a language. The larger hearing community need to accept that.
So speaking of this awareness, tell us about your experiences while you were filming. You had mentioned that you felt that you were the one impaired when you were in the deaf community.
Oh yeah, that was, I think, one of the most fascinating experiences of my life, where I, being a hearing person myself, you know, it kind of just hit me that how it is easy for us to just address somebody as, oh, maybe he or she is handicapped, or maybe, you know, he or she belongs to the disability, you know, group. Because one of the deaf persons in my documentary, he pointed out that in one of the conversations, and I've shot this in the documentary, he said, when a hearing person comes into our community, he or she is handicapped. So being handicapped is just a label. So if the hearing world calls me handicapped, it's fine. But when you come into my community, you are also handicapped. And of course, he was absolutely 100% right, because when I went to their community, I was there for like 3-4 months just shooting with them and trying to talk to them rather. And in one of the conversations, I was trying to have this conversation with one of the deaf persons where, you know, we were trying to schedule an interview. And he was talking to the interpreter, and the interpreter and this deaf person, they were constantly communicating, and I was just left like an outsider there. I kept just looking at their faces, not knowing what they were talking about. And they were talking about the documentary. They were talking about scheduling the interview. And I myself was like totally oblivious to what they were talking. And I said, wow, I'm handicapped here. And they're so right about it. So it's about different perspective. You know, it's about having a different perspective, a different aspect of life that I got to know about it. And I hope when people watch this document, they also get to know about it.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to APA Compass on KBOO. I'm Sarika Mehta, and we're featuring an interview with Vidyuthlate, director of the documentary film Beyond Silence. This film chronicles the experiences of the Mumbai deaf community. In the next part of the interview, we discuss the perspectives of the hearing families of the deaf people in the film, many of whom don't sign. And also in your movie, you interviewed a number of deaf adults. The parents of some of these deaf adults who don't sign, but they have obviously raised these children in Bombay, and you had some really touching stories. So talk about the stories and also how you were able to form this relationship with these families.
Talking to parents of deaf children, I would say it was an overwhelming experience, more so because they wanted to share so much about their lives, about the struggles they have gone through. Because let's understand, I mean, Indian society is different than most of the Western societies that have accepted deafness as a way of life, comparatively at least. So in India, it's still, I mean, it's almost like a taboo to talk about, oh, your child is deaf. Oh my God, is it some past life curse? Is it your karma? You know, so there are lots of other things that probably most educated and modern people cannot really even empathize with that. What? I mean, what has it got to do with any curse? But that's the reality. You're born deaf because probably you did something wrong in your past life. And that's what people try to associate with you. So when I was talking to these parents of deaf children, I would say they were so welcoming. And they really probably liked the fact that somebody is just interested to know about their lives. Because most often, you know, it's more like, oh, your child is deaf, you need help, you need support. And there's more of, you know, sympathy associated with it, which they just want somebody to hear them out. And there were incidences, like I spoke to these parents, and they told me the struggles that they have gone through, about how their neighbors didn't allow their kids to play with their kids just because they were deaf. You know, as if it's some kind of a contagious disease. So you can imagine the kind of awareness one has living in a society like that. And so that was alarming for me. And it was very touchy, where some of the parents really cried on camera and they said, we are very proud about our deaf children, and they are better than our hearing children. Because, yeah, they are extremely, extremely loving. They care about us. They are more understanding because they probably understand the unspoken emotions, you know, that we emote to them as their parents. And most hearing kids probably, you know, want them to be said, oh, we love you, you know, okay, baby, you know, we love you a lot. But probably a deaf kid just understands looking at his or her mom, you know. So I think that is what they were trying to emphasize, that they understand the hidden emotions, the unspoken love for their kids. And they're so understanding, they're so loving, they're so mature. Even if, like, they were living in a city like Mumbai, which is so noisy, parents of most deaf girls, they're worried about them. Obviously, you know, being a girl, that too, in a crowded city like Mumbai, that itself can be very overwhelming for any parent. Here was a lady, a mother of a deaf girl. She said, I'm so confident about my child. Of course, I'm very, very protective towards her. And that is another thing that I could understand from their conversations. They are very protective about their kids. And that also becomes a major tiff between the kids and the parents, because obviously the parents want to protect their kids. As such, it's difficult for a hearing person to survive in a big city, but for probably deaf kids, it's going to be all the more difficult.
And to be fair, all of our parents were protective of us, no matter what city we grew up in.
Exactly.
Hearing, deaf,
exactly.
American or Indian, we all had to struggle with our protective parents.
Absolutely. I mean, I love Mumbai city, but you're right. Like, every parent is always going to be extremely protective about their kid, you know, whether it's Mumbai, Delhi, like anywhere in the world, San Francisco, Los Angeles. But here the case was about, you know, okay, they are deaf and it's a noisy city, it's a crowded city. If my kid goes out, and what if he or she doesn't hear a car honking, and, you know, what if he gets run down by a car or a bus, you know. Yeah, absolutely. And that is something the deaf kids really didn't like, obviously, because, you know, nobody's going to like their parents being overprotective. And so we actually have a conversation there in the documentary where this amazing mother of two deaf kids, she's saying, why don't you guys just come home early? And these deaf kids are saying, oh, come on, why are you being so overprotective? Just let us be. And so that was fascinating. So I would say the debates and discussions, like any other family, were absolutely the same. But yes, the parents of deaf kids, they did have slightly more to talk about their deaf kids, and that was that they were extremely proud about them.
That's one great positive thing that has probably come out of this discussion. We've talked about the challenges of the parents raising deaf children in India with the lack of awareness and all other barriers to access to information. Since shooting the film, have you seen any other positive results come out of access for the deaf community or other changes?
I worked with the Aliyawar Jung National Institute of Hearing Handicapped while I was shooting the documentary. And I've got to know that they have introduced several courses, you know, where they are trying to make media accessible for disabled people. That has been, I would say, massive, you know, awareness about disability issues, about obviously, you know, primarily deafness. And sign language interpreting has also, as I said, when I was shooting the documentary, the number of interpreters was far less than what it is now. I mean, 250. It does sound very less in comparison to probably many other countries, but when I was shooting, the figures were really, really low. So that has definitely improved. I mean, not improved to the extent that we can say it's amazing and it's the best for the country, but that has definitely improved. There are talks of improving accessibility to media services in India. Obviously, sign language, introduction of sign language in schools, that is also, you know, talked about. And while I was working on the documentary, I worked with this really great organization, Ishara Foundation, which emphasizes on bilingual education. So at that time, they were visiting around 9 deaf schools, and their volunteers used to go to these deaf schools and teach English in sign language. I'm sure now that has also maybe expanded. I don't know exactly, I don't have the figures, you know, to how many schools now they go and visit. But at that time, they had started that whole movement, and it was really showing great results. So yeah, I mean, there's definitely some improvement, but it's still not there.
How have the reactions been in the hearing communities, and how have the reactions been in the deaf communities, both here and abroad?
It's amazing because, firstly, I think this film may be probably one of the first films I would say. I can say that is championing the deaf cause without labeling the deaf community as handicapped or putting forward an issue which is a disability issue. So whenever I even submit my film to festivals, I don't like to showcase it as a disability issue film. You know, it's not that. It's a human issue. So the acceptance at, I would say, at film festivals and, you know, whatever public screenings and private screenings we've had has been amazing, because here is a perspective where we are trying to put forward a kind of thinking that, okay, probably we lack one of the sensibilities that other hearing people have, but this is our life and we are happy to be in our skin. We are happy to be deaf. So try and listen to our perspective. I think that is what people have loved about the film. And that is what when people see and they say, wow, we never thought about it. Like, for example, there's a couple in the film that is deaf. They have a hearing child. And they say, oh, we are very obviously proud and happy to have a hearing child, but we would have been happier if she was deaf. So I think such things are really new for people. But that itself shows. And they say, the mother of the kid, she says that, you know, if a deaf kid is, it helps in growing deaf generations, which is fascinating. This whole idea itself is very fascinating for hearing people all around the world. And it has gone to festivals. It was at the Cannes Film Short Film Corner, at Cyprus, in Greece. It actually had its Indian premiere in Mumbai just a month back. And in fact, won an award, a short documentary award. So, I mean, that itself, you know, kind of really gives you that recognition and that proof that, okay, people are somewhere, you know, liking the fact that here is a perspective. It might be definitely different than most perspectives you hear and see about people, you know, who are conventionally having a handicap or they come under the umbrella of disability issue. But here is a perspective, you know, we need to listen them out. Whether you agree or not, it's totally different. Because when you talk about deaf people, you have, you know, things about cochlear implant and, you know, recognition and identification of deafness in early ages and how deafness can be corrected. You know, those topics are going to come up. And we can have separate discussions for that. But we, at this moment, the discussion is about accepting the deaf life. And this is what I think people have very gradually, of course, you know, it's a moment, it's going to take time, but very gradually people have started accepting that. And in fact, Mike Morgan in the film, he also emphasized that in many countries, deaf people have started advocating the fact that sign language or deafness is one of the ethnicities. So deaf people belong to an ethnic group.
What would you like people to get out of your film if you, I mean, many things I'm sure, but if you had to collapse it into, you know, one answer.
I definitely want people to watch this film and take away with them the very simple thing, live and let live. Don't try to change somebody just because you belong to a majority community. Just, you know, don't try to make somebody talk to you in the same tone because you talk to them in the same language or in a particular language. So it's something like, you know, if you don't agree with somebody, agree to disagree. So if they have a way of life, you need to acknowledge that. You may not like it. You may not agree with it. I mean, I would say most people who are, you know, who advocate cochlear implants and who advocate changing deafness into, you know, into hearing, and that are, you know, just trying to teach deaf students only through oral methods, they probably will have a big issue in accepting that, oh, you know, you're not going to teach students through oral methods? Oh, come on, how are they going to get educated? So there's going to be a huge debate about it. But that's fine. What we are trying to make people understand and to take away from this film is just hear them out, you know, actually hear them out. And I think the onus is on us, because when you go to a foreign country, you know, you don't try to expect a French guy to talk to you in English. You know, you'll probably start learning, you know, a little bit of French about how to say good morning, good evening. And it's the same territory, I would say. If you want to go and communicate with a deaf person, try and learn the nuances of their culture. Try and learn some little words here and there about, you know, sign language, and just you'll just discover it's so fascinating. So that's how you're going to communicate better. Because deaf people, definitely, they understand. They are educating themselves bilingually. Everybody is doing that, and they have to do that. Most deaf kids and deaf students in India, they have to actually learn four languages. Yeah. One is an international sign language, one is an Indian sign language, English, obviously, because it's universally accepted, and their local language. So you can see the onus is so much on them for them to literate themselves in four languages. So, you know, learning one more language and just trying to, you know, better that communication gap, I think is the need of the hour. And that is definitely going to give more acceptance and acknowledgement. And it's a human issue. Let's not, you know, make it a disability issue or something, you know, which we just have to put under the umbrella of, oh, it's not my issue. No, it is a human issue. It's our issue. It's a fellow human being's issue. But to say it in a very concise way, what people should take away from this film is the acceptance of deaf life, of their language, and their way of life. Yes.
Thank you so much for chatting with me.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me. Thank you.
That was Vidhu Zlate, filmmaker and director of the documentary Beyond Silence. This film profiles the deaf community in Mumbai, India. Vidhu Zlate met me in Los Angeles back in March. You can learn more about her and her film at her website, vidhuzlate.com. I'm Sari Gametha, and you've been listening to APA Compass on KBOO.
And bringing them home to you. It's the Tiki Cha-Cha Club, KBOO's all-vinyl guilty pleasure. Monday nights, midnight to 1 a.m. on 90.7 FM stereo and around the world at KBOO.FM.
Tune in to Higher Reasoning Reggae every Sunday morning at 3 a.m. Higher Reasoning Reggae is dedicated to bringing international reggae word and sound power to the massive airing early Sunday mornings at 3 a.m., only on KBOO Portland.
And you are listening to KBOO Portland, where the time is approximately 9:59 a.m. Coming up at 10, both Air Cascadia and Flashpoints are off today. Instead, we'll hear Radio EcoShock on preparing personal solutions, clothes, medicine, money, food. At 11 on It Takes a Village, host Shahid Hamid interviews Michael Alexander, president of the Urban League of Portland. And at 11:30, we hear an interview with writer and activist Rebecca Solnit on her book, Hollow City, which she wrote to document the beauty and rich culture of San Francisco that was being destroyed by wealth and to inspire the growing movement of resistance. Thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you are not a member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and click on Donate Today.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Are your clothes safe? Alina Bartel, owner of the Natural Clothing Company, advises us on fabrics, chemicals, and organic clothes. Dr. Joe Alton, MD, about learning emergency medicine when help doesn't come. Woody Tash helps develop local food with slow money. It's Radio EcoShock. Hi there, I'm Alex Smith. We're back with more local solutions for global problems from the Mother Earth News Fair. This time I've picked three of the most intriguing interviews. Each seemed at first like a small problem, and then each guest, all feature speakers at the fair, takes us much deeper into the industrial and financial mess and out again with practical things we can do.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with a bit of an embarrassing question for you. Are the clothes you're wearing right now safe? And what about that cheap stuff you got for the kids at the big box store? It's the kind of thing we almost don't want to talk about, but these are products from a super industrial society that we put right next to our skin for hours at a time. Here to talk to us about that is Alina Bartel. She's the owner of the Natural Clothing Company. They retail eco-friendly and organic clothing, and they're based in Snohomish County in Washington. Is
that
correct?
That's right.
USA? Good. Well, welcome to Radio EcoShock, Alina.
Thank you very much for having me.
It's a bit of a tough question. I mean, in a way, some people don't want to hear about this. It's a little close to home to think that maybe the clothes you're wearing are not safe for you. Can you talk to us about that?
Oh, absolutely. It is a difficult question because our environment, period, is not that safe. So,